Very interesting thing about it. Have you ever thought about, if you thought about capitalist economics at all, those terms, supply and demand, both are entirely within the control of demand. Is first of all capital goods, which is in the control, and secondly, and probably of more importance to us, consumer goods, which is primarily the working class. But the working class's ability to buy, their effective demand, is entirely governed by their pay packets, again, entirely within the control of capital. So supply and demand are in fact not free-floating variables, as every capitalist economist would try to teach you, but they are totally within the control of capital. Now, capital is not a disembodied entity with a brain which can control it. As our friend has implied, it is the market, and the market is chaos, because there are all sorts of attempts to upset the market, to corner the market, to control the market. There is, in fact, no way of controlling production and capitalism. So socialism must set this to rights. The very first thing that a socialist society must do is have a system of information, of worldwide information. Now, the technology is there and the workers are there. The satellites are there, the communication systems are there, the interlocking computer systems are there, the stock control methods are there, the productivity measuring techniques are there. We can know, and capitalism could know in 5 years' time down to very tiny detail, what was needed anywhere in the world. Capitalism does not want to. The other thing that a socialist society must have, which capitalist society avoids like the plague, and that is discussion. Have you noticed the tender hands, the gloved hands with which they discuss products on television? Because, of course, they're afraid of upsetting a manufacturer or even a branch of the trade. What there will be in socialism is perennial discussion of products compared with one another in a whole groups, and this will form a very large part, not only of discussion at small level, but discussion at what are now nations, but won't be nations, but areas in socialism, and discussion at world. Moreover, and probably most important of all, the worker in capitalism has no say whatsoever, not only in what he produces, but in what is done with it or anything else. Now, in a socialist society, the worker will be free to add his voice just as much as a worker as a consumer, and probably more so. And workers in the cosmetics industry, if it continues to exist, which I doubt, may well say, we are not going to process anything produced by scraping the backside of civet cats. We are not going to deal in musk. Or the workers in medical research may well say, we are no longer going to do vivisection. Workers will have this ability to decide. They may decide not on that sort of animal welfare basis at all. They may decide on their own basis. We are no longer going to protect the surface of steel with nitric acid because of what it does to people, because people grow tall and thin and emaciated even if they continue to live when they are near nitric acid plating, cleaning tanks all their lives. But our friend here talks about the division of labour. The division of labour is a capitalist concept. Now, I'm not saying that in socialism there will not be certain jobs to be done, but the idea that somebody will be an electrician in socialism is ludicrous. He will be a human being, and if he wishes to choose to work with electrics for part of his life, for Saturday afternoons, or for 3 days a week, that will be entirely up to him. But he will probably do half a dozen different things in the week, and he will probably do 50 different things in his lifetime, and maybe more. So that we are talking now about human beings. And the trouble with the criticism of socialism is it cannot think, at the moment, it cannot think along any other lines than capitalist lines. If the question comes back again, for goodness sake, let us abandon the capitalist lumber and start thinking of the way in which a society might be organised, and we'll have to concentrate on this country because most of us aren't familiar enough with Peru, though they have probably got their ideas there as well. Let's concentrate on this country, which we know something about, and say how it might be organised, and it might in this country. But for goodness sake, let's throw the capitalist lumber overboard first. Right, now then.
I was recalling a part of what the question to the chairman was saying a few minutes ago when he said, we're getting more to eat. Of course we're getting more to eat. What sort of food are we eating? In the Guardian this week I noticed an article where the meat market in Gordon, this country, released 714 tons of contaminated meat. And there was a mould on it of 3 inches thick. And all it said that the butcher would take or cut off the 3 inches of mould and just sell it to the ordinary people. It is known, and it is stated, that preparation of the soil and crops are producing chemically poisonous food. And the evidence is more growing cases of food poisoning. Cancer in children, which never was known in my generation. A case in point where I was giving food relief to a starving section of Abyssinia and various other parts of Africa, with providing free milk powder. They had to mix this milk powder with polluting water. Where if they'd given the proper food, which they required, such as maize and wheat and anything else that they would naturally a part of their diet, it had been consumed by the mother, we'd have to provide him with natural milk. It wasn't contaminated at all. They couldn't afford to purify the water where the native went down to the polluted rivers and just cupped over it and mixed it with the milk powder and was giving disease to the child. All this evidence is that we're not producing the food, we're producing worse food. Now these are one of the things that average you start thinking about, you start talking about better food.
Back then, I agree that we should discard completely and sell food and talked about the socialist revolution. I'd like to know what your idea of the socialist revolution is and how it will take place.
Yeah, well, at the moment, I think, contrary to what was said before, in all of these answers, you have to go back to the way things are at the moment, just as a starting point. Certainly at the moment, capitalism survives because the majority of people accept it. In fact, they would probably fight to defend it. And in order for that change to take place, you've got to, before you get socialism, you've got to get a majority of socialists. I think you would agree on that. The way in which the majority of people at the moment demonstrate their support for capitalism is by putting the power of coercion into the hand of a minority. In short, I'll give you a very good example of how this works. There was a policeman strike in Liverpool some years ago. Police wanted to form a trade union and they weren't allowed to, and they went out on strike. The local council sent a memo to the local police force commander and said, have these men arrested. He passed it on to the local police force, some of whom found themselves given a car and asked them to go out and arrest themselves. And what they did was they passed it to their colleagues who weren't on strike, who duly arrested them. They ended up in prison. Now that's a pretty good example of what happens when people put power in the hands of the state and ask them to do their thinking and organising for them. Now, what will happen when people want socialism is, instead of putting that power through the ballot box into the hands of a minority, we will organise to put that power politically into the hands of the whole community. Now that will, of course, certainly in this country and several other countries, involve getting control of things like Parliament, and sending delegates there. And that's a very important point when I say sending delegates. Not sending representatives or leaders, but sending people who are given a clear mandate to get rid of capitalism. The next thing that it will involve is taking away those powers of coercion from the minority and putting them in the hands of the majority in order to safeguard the majority decision against any minority who will want to interfere with it. That is to say, the armed forces and all of the organs of the state have to be put in the hands of a socialist majority in order for a socialist revolution to be successful and to be defended if necessary. And thirdly, and this is the most important thing, the revolutionary act, so to speak, is to actually dispossess the minority of their ownership of the music world production. It means taking away the farms, taking away the factories, taking away the mines, and putting them in the hands, not of the state, but of the community as a whole. Now that's the way in which we're suggesting that this revolution can be brought about. It can't be done in just one country, because we're dealing with world capitalism, and obviously therefore the only solution is world socialism. And what I would say is most important is we've got to start off from actually where we are at the moment in order to get there. In other words, the practical details of exactly what will happen during the course of a socialist revolution is hard to tell. Some people say socialists won't get control of the media until after the revolution. Frankly, I think socialists might get control of a large part of the media long before the revolution, perhaps even in the not very distant future. There will be large sections of the world media which will simply be under the control of socialists, using it for our own needs. But the most immediate and practical detail we need to ask is, how do we build up the movement in terms of each city, each town, each village throughout the world? And there, in a sense, is where your contribution to that revolution has to start, by effectively putting your commitment on the side of that socialist revolution and the political organisation which is working for it in this country.
Clarification. Do you imagine the socialist revolution coming through Parliament, through the use of Parliament, or taking over Parliament?
Yeah.
Through the use of Parliament.
Through the use of Parliament.
So by elected members or something?
By elected members who will act as delegates and not as MPs, not sitting in Parliament for years on end, but going there for a short period with one simple objective to take place. And having done that, that will in fact mean the end of Parliament. It will mean the setting up after that of democracy, because I mean, where you have a Parliament, you're handing over power to a minority.
I think you'd agree with me that the power in this country is not in the hands of Parliament, but in the actual capitalists who own the means of production and also who own considerable amount of their wealth. And as a socialist who believes in the revolution, I can't imagine that the capitalists are willingly going to give away that wealth and all the means of production without some kind of trouble.
Well, what are they going to do? What effectively can they do?
By employing the army and the police that is already in their custody to fight against the socialist movement.
Well, I mean, the thing there is that the army and the police is primarily made up of members of the working class. Now, it's quite true, and I'll concede to you the point. Certainly, some members of the working class, even up to the point of a revolution, will be bought off by the capitalist class, by propaganda and so forth, to support them. But what you've got to also realise is, because socialism means a majority of people will be socialists, what is that army and that police force and that capitalist class itself going to really do in order to stand in the way of the majority? You see, an army can't run without petrol to drive its lorries. It can't run without a munitions industry. It can't run without clothing. It certainly can't run without a water supply. It can't run without electricity and without gas. Now, the working class effectively have the power, and a socialist working class would have the power, to control those things. And given a socialist revolution, the working class would simply say, look, we are going to now transfer production from the needs of the capitalists to our own needs. And if they say, send us a memo and say, provide petrol for soldiers or for tanks or ammunition bullets or whatever, this would not happen. Now, it's quite true that in the case of the socialist revolution, there may well be some people who want to violently defend capitalism. And if they do, and if there is a majority who wish to have socialism, then that minority would have obviously to be taken on. But of course, that would be a perfectly democratic and reasonable way of saying to people, we are the majority, we want things run in the interest of the majority, and if necessary, we'll enforce the majority's needs and desire in whatever way we have to. And of course, we're not pacifists in that sense. If what socialists oppose, of course, is the use of violence in the defence of capitalism, in the defence of, you know, opposing interests to our own. But if we have to use violence in order to defend our own interests, whilst I think at least for most of us it's something we don't want to do, we're probably as socialists on the whole opposed to violence as such, it's something which we have to contemplate.
Granted, yeah. But through your speak to the Workers' Revolutionary Party and the Socialist Workers' Party, and I heard the mention of guns and so forth there. I'm familiar with Socialist Worker Party and so forth. I wonder what your criticism of the Socialist Worker Party would be.
Well,
their argument is virtually along the same lines as yours, not entering Parliament, admittedly, but of seizing power from the capitalists.
Well, there's a significant difference. Look, what we're opposing with the Socialist Workers' Party when they talk about guns and barricades and so on is the idea of a minority revolution. Now, if you look at what the Socialist Workers' Party in the end say, they take the position, and they quite openly state, is of Lenin, that you've got to have a minority leadership who take power, as happened in Russia in 1917, on behalf of the working class. In other words, you have a vanguard which does the thinking and the acting for the working class. Now, what we are saying is that if you have a vanguard doing the work for the working class in terms of political action, you will have the consequences that you had in Russia in terms of Leninism and Stalinism. You will have a society where the majority of people don't know what they're doing. They have to carry on following after the revolution just as they did before the revolution. And what you have in the end is a dictatorship over the proletariat. Now, we don't think that you can use guns in order to establish socialism at all. What you can do is possibly and maybe necessarily use guns in order to defend that society against anyone who wants to attack it. That's something which is in the future and we can only speculate. What we know as a matter of certainty is that from where we are standing now, the working class between them as a class internationally has got so much power that there is absolutely no one who bullets need to be fired at. You cannot get socialism through the barrel of a gun. You can get it through ideas, you can get it through the brain, you can get it through conscious political action. And if you decide, as the Socialist Workers' Party do, that the only possibility for the working class is to have leaders whom they will follow, then what you are more or less saying is that the only possibility for the working class is to remain a class which is always acquiescent to someone else, always leaving the thinking to someone else. Of course, our criticism of the Socialist Workers' Party goes far more than that. Socialist Workers' Party not only have a 19th century idea of revolution based upon barricades in the street, which were in fact capitalist revolutions, revolutions to bring about capitalism, but what they also do is that they have a completely incorrect idea about what can be done with capitalism. They believe that if you carry on reforming capitalism, you can get all kinds of things out of it which are somehow valuable for the working class. Whereas what the Socialist Party of Great Britain says is there's only one thing that's valuable for the working class, and that is to get shot of capitalism. Not to change it, not to reform it, not to elect a Labour government rather than a Tory one. Yet the Socialist Workers' Party in the last election urged people to vote for the Labour Party. Socialist Workers' Party at the moment says that a victory for Tony Benn as deputy leader of the Labour Party will be a victory for the working class. Socialist Workers' Party has spoken about all kinds of policies for the British government and for British capitalism and for world capitalism, which have got absolutely nothing to do with the working class. And any member of the working class who comes across the Socialist Workers' Party will say, if we need to be told how to run capitalism, we can follow the Labour Party or the Tory Party. They've got abundant policies to tell us how to do that. And any member of the capitalist class who comes across the Socialist Workers' Party, he'll say, look, quite honestly, we don't need Tony Cliff and Paul Foot. We've got plenty of economists of our own telling us how to reform capitalism. We'll do it ourselves.
Well, with all my dealings with the Socialist Workers' Party, I've definitely not found that they've opposed capitalism, and you say their support for telling people to elect the Labour Party, and within the party system they disagree entirely with what the Labour Party is trying to achieve.
They
know the limits of Tony Benn's ideas completely and utterly, but what they're trying to achieve is a broad front for socialism to get socialist ideas working through the questions that Tony Benn is starting to ask about Parliament and the way the Labour Party is run, to devise even more questions about democracy and how democracy should run and so forth. They are not using the Labour Party as a means for socialism. They're using the Labour Party and the evils within capitalism to open questions that will lead people to the ideas of socialism. They're not trying to substantiate capitalism within the world system. And also, with the Socialist Workers Party, I mean, this Liberal, we've got something like 57 left-wing factions outside of the Labour Party, or something ridiculous like this. And it's unbelievable to me that we should have so many groups like this. And it seems almost impossible to me also that you can expect the working class as a collective body to unite when they look at the left-wing, revolutionary left-wing groups and see so many factions within it. And when so-called left-wing revolutionary groups start attacking one another on what I consider ideas that are ingrained within socialism, because you're always going to have competition within socialism still about ideas, it seems very futile, and that supports capitalism.
I'll just put in one word before I've got two speakers here, and that is this. To our disappointment, the Socialist Party of Great Britain was formed in 1904, which means to say we haven't got very far yet. But look at what happened after that, with the formation of the British Labour Party as the Labour Representation Committee, who said to us, repeatedly and very loudly, you're not going to get socialism, let's do something about capitalism. I mean, it happened before in Germany with the Social Democratic Party. Then the formation of the Communist Party, who said, it's being done, it's all happening in Russia, you can forget your working class thing, getting working class consciousness, it's being done. Now, this is what has factionalised the left. The belief that they can do something other than work for socialism. And this is the criticism which Steve made about the Socialist Workers' Party. The fact that they think that there's something which can be done within capitalism. We've been telling them since 1904, and every world event has proved us right. Yet they are still looking for a quick road. 100 years on from the Social Democratic Federation, they're looking for a quick road. Well, hadn't they better start looking for the right road?
Well, I'm sorry. That, it's a rhetorical question, you know. It's the back there.
Yeah, I think it's one very fundamental difference between the Socialist Party of Great Britain and the Socialist Workers' Party. It's not only in the means by which the Socialist Revolution probably brought it down. Is actually what we mean by socialism. And if you look at the Socialist Party's great idea of socialism, you see it's completely different than the Socialist Workers' Party. When the Socialist Party Great Britain talks about socialism, and we're communism, we mean nothing less or nothing short of the complete abolition of the life of a static society, a monolithic society. And the Socialist Workers Party is just not its aim. Well, it might be in the very, very distant future. But what they want to establish immediately, and really what they are mean, really seriously talk about, is some kind of a state capitalism. It really is a complete nationalisation of the productive forces of the means of producing distributing wealth. They do often allude to something about the Monash Wave Society, but this is a very low and aspect of that theory, you know, and they don't really seriously consider it, you know. So I think that the Socialist Party is different, not only in means or the way it's going to be about socialism, but more fundamentally, more basically, in what it's out to achieve, you know.
Just answering the friend here. The Socialist Workers Party is completely opposed to state capitalism. An example of which is Russia and Tony Cliff's many critiques about it. And so
what does he want to achieve?
He wants to achieve a socialist society in exactly the same way as the Socialist Party of Great Britain does. Obviously, there are fundamental differences in the way that we actually want to go about it. But Socialist Workers Party believe in actually getting industry, workers in industry involved in strike movements and so forth, and developing confidence in their own ability and so forth is a very important.
Can I ask you, speak, if you've ever met a member of the Socialist Workers Party that really seriously talks about something like the abolition of the wage system? A state of society.
Yeah, I've actually read pieces of it, yes.
But you see, one of the things which is coming.
The wage of society is, as our friend here has said, is something that is in the very far future, as is a social society. I recognise that, and most socialists would recognise that, because we have got to get the majority of people in tune with the ideas of socialism. But this interfighting between socialist party is very futile and very destructive towards socialism.
Well, why
it's the people to the right that we should be converting, and not people with socialist ideas already.
Well, my question still stands there, my rhetorical question. Why didn't they join the SPGB in the first place, if there wasn't that much difference? We were there first. I mean, it's no satisfaction to us to have been there first, but why didn't they join us?
Well, I can't answer that, because I don't know.
The point I'd make is, if you want to make a journey from A to B, and there's a motorway between it, do you have to go along all the B roads and come back to the motorway? All the blind alleys? You know where you want to go. Well, why do you have to go all the blind alleys? And that's where the Socialist Workers Party seem to be leading, in the claim that it will educate them on the way. The majority of people get so frustrated they'll go back to where they came from.
Well, don't you believe that people have to be educated in socialism?
You're talking as a leadership again, you said.
Well, so people don't have to have socialist ideas for the socialist revolution.
There's nobody out there who is any less capable of understanding what socialism is about than people in here. It's not a complex idea at all.
I know, I agree with you entirely, but those people out there don't know what socialism is.
But it's not because they can't understand it, and you therefore don't have to lead them.
I know, yeah, but my friend here says that he don't have to. That you should educate them. Of course, you've got to educate them.
Say socialism
and the direction of socialism.
I didn't say that you should educate them. What I'm saying is that the Socialist Workers' Party is claiming that by sending everybody up blind alleys,
it's not claiming that at all. It's claiming to socialism.
Supporting the Labour Party is going up a blind alley.
It doesn't support the Labour Party. I've already stated.
But its literature asks people to vote Labour on certain occasions.
Now, because there isn't a Socialist Party of Great Britain member to vote for.
But it implies that there's a difference between Labour and Tory.
I don't.
It implies that there's a difference between Labour and Tory. Material difference.
It implies that there is a difference. As I've said, it generates so-called socialist thoughts. It sees what Tony Benn does, and then it will, when the next Labour government gets in, it will prove that the Labour policies are, as you have already said, virtually the same as the Tory government. And then it will start to argue that what you need is a real socialist party outside of the parliamentary system that is going to achieve socialism through revolution.
Well, how many times does this need to be done? I mean, how many Labour governments have we had since the Labour Party was
formed? That's not the fault of the Socialist Workers Party, surely. It's the fault of the electorate.
No, but I mean, what they're implying is that you don't yet know the answer about Labour politicians and about Labour governments, but you do know the answer. The historical record's there.
Well, they obviously don't, because they keep voting in that.
You do.
I do, yes.
But you're trying.
I don't go out and vote Labour.
You're pretending you don't, you see.
I don't pretend that I do. I don't go out and vote Labour. And I'm pretty certain that more Socialist Workers Party members don't go out and vote Labour. But what you've got to realise is that you're appealing to a mass of people out there who've got absolutely no ideas of the ideas of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, nor of the Socialist Workers Party of Great Britain.
Bill, speaking of putting it back, supposing you just told them to do as we do, tell them to do, write socialism across your ballot paper.
One here.
I'd like to go back for a moment, if I could, to what was being discussed just earlier. Obviously, we can come back to this in a moment, if need be. Because I've just found a reference here which makes a very interesting comment on the idea of the market system. On the whether or not the price mechanism, the market system, is capable of transporting food to people who want it quickly and efficiently. And our friend here said it's no good having socialism where you abolish all of the prices and monetary system, because it's that we rely on to make these quick decisions. Well, the example quoted here, and the information is from the United States Department of Agriculture. It explains how during the late 60s and early 70s there was what they called an official food surplus in America. It doesn't mean that people were full of food across the world, obviously. It means that according to the criteria of profit and marketability. Anyhow, they took out 20 million hectares were taken out of production, grain in America, towards the end of the 60s, which means that they lost effectively 90 million tonnes of wheat, or, you know, were not produced, which could have been. Now, a few years later, there was a world food crisis, as usual, and there was a conference on food crisis, starvation. And at the World Food Conference, the Director General of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization pleaded, it says here, to the manufacturers for just 8 to 12 million tonnes a week to feed the starving millions in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan and Tanzania. They only wanted 12 million tonnes a week to feed these starving millions. They lost 90 million over the previous few years by this monetary trickery, by taking 20 million hectares out of production to keep prices up. And all he wanted, all they wanted was 12 million tonnes a week to feed the starving millions. And what was the answer? The answer was no, we can't produce it because it wouldn't be profitable to us to produce it. That's just a small anecdote to show you how the market system is destructive and does not work. But another point, just on the same page whilst I'm at it, in case you think this doesn't affect you because you're not one of the starving millions, it points out, just on the same page, that the United States Bureau of Census stated in 1975, quote, at least 12 million Americans are starving or sick because they have too little to spend on food. So that's just an example of how people in supposedly advanced nations or countries are suffering equally from that market system. I'd just like to add that something, an example closer to home, in fact, is wine. Because wine is something which is obviously counted as something of a luxury by practically everybody probably in this country, most people in this country, to have any amount of wine over a long period of time can be quite expensive. And yet that's one of the commodities specifically which is in surplus at the moment in Europe, the famous wine lakes. So you see how whether you're in America, Europe, or the so-called third world countries, the market system gets to you wherever you are in various ways. I think that the idea of a system based on need, a socialist society, as the chairman has said, has the means at the disposal to solve these problems simply on the basis of who wants what, and you get it directly to them. And I think on this example of the grain, where they needed 10 million tonnes of grain of wheat, that probably could have been sold with hardly more than a telephone call. One telephone call across the ocean to say, right, we need this much wheat then, and so we bring it back into production, and in the following year, the problem solved. So it's not technology that's missing, and we don't need a price system to make that phone call and to impart that information. The market system is in fact the obstacle to people getting what they want.
Down front
here. Yes, I'd like to just say a passing comment on the left and right wing. Of course, the groups on the left and the right wing aren't necessarily identical with each other at all. There's different groups, and these different groups have their differences, and their differences can be quite vast. And the left and right wing way of thinking is part of the way of thinking in order to prevent further thinking, which is dominant in current policies, politics today, and also the way people think about politics. If they had to drop this way of thinking and have a look at what these various people say, then they wouldn't get so confused. I suppose I'll leave the SPGB to defend themselves against the Socialist Workers' Party, who certainly supported the sort of state capitalism that they had in Russia from 1917 to 1921, and go on to the main issue. The issue of the economic, again, I must emphasise that there is this difference, and in emphasising that there's a difference between the problem of solving economic calculation in the new society and the way our economic calculation is solved in today's society. I don't want to ban discussion on capitalism. We can talk about capitalism if you like, but the point is, however much we run down capitalism, however many faults we find in capitalism, it is a fact that capitalism is here. It is the status quo, capitalism is, and capitalism keeps everybody alive who is alive today, so it's successful insofar as it does that. The thing is to have a look to see whether there is an alternative. Now, I said earlier on that there is no new society growing in the womb of capitalism. Now, let's have a look at the problem of economic calculation in the new society. Now, economic calculation is a fast problem. I said earlier on that committees would slow it down. The chairman went on to say that we had techniques of computers and information systems. He's quite right, we have got these. But the point is they're all too slow. The chairman himself doesn't know what he wants to, what he'll want tomorrow. The way of solving the economic problem is catering to people's wants pretty immediately. And the reason why we need some sort of system to cater to people's needs pretty immediately is because we need to motivate people. It is a matter of incentives. What you need is some sort of substitute for the price system, which is out of control, which is anarchic. And this, of course, will not satisfy Marx. Marx, as a matter of fact, was an old Tory. He was a reactionary. Capital is a book about reaction, Tory reaction, to liberalism or capitalism. There is nothing revolutionary in Marx. That's just moaning and droning about the present system. And nothing whatsoever to replace it with. Marx doesn't address the problem of how to replace the new society. He, of course, answers in a piece of chicanery, which was echoed and paraphrased by the main speaker, that we can't go around writing blueprints for the future society. But, of course, the demand is not for a blueprint, but for a theory. And a theory is radically different from a blueprint. A theory which will have to be a prerequisite to any new society will be a theory, a collection of generalisations, like any other theory, of roughly how things will function in the new society. And this will be, I think, if we can solve this problem, which I'm not sure that we can do so, this will be an anarchic theory. In other words, you will not have a central plan, which is, of course, Marx's dear dreams, although this is much hidden, and many of the SPG beers don't even realise that the idea of Marxism is a grand central plan. It is the grand planned economy. Marx's main objection to capitalism is that it's not planned, is that it's anarchic. I think that any viable economic system, I think that all the pre-capitalist societies were anarchic. I think capitalism is anarchic. I think the socialist society, if it's ever going to be achieved, will also be anarchic. In other words, it will be decentralised and there will be no central plan.
Yes, Jules, I think we're running a bit close to time then. Come on.
Just a little bit, shall we? We'll just add our friend, you see, when he made his previous speech, he did mention about the effects of the bomb in Hiroshima, or something like that, and there were 100,000 killed. He compared that with the rest of the popular audience. And he says, that's 100,000 killed from one bomb. But he didn't go on to say, I mean, the experience that I've had have been two world wars where millions and millions of people have been killed and blasted and terrorised, blinded, everything you can think of. And not only these two world wars, but ever since, we've had wars all over the world. Women, children, men being slaughtered. It doesn't mention it. He's trying to uphold capitalism. And it's capitalism which causes this. What the hell? If the Socialist Party put forward a theory of socialism, which at least to me is a very sensible, clear analysis of society, and is quite easy to understand. I know that people haven't yet come to grips with it. But when we get socialism, surely we shall have a class society where people will have a completely different outlook on life. Everything they do and say today almost takes on a capitalist, is reflective of capitalism. You'll find that families, one against another, one friend can't trust another. And that's the sort of thing that goes on all the way through. And all the waste, he didn't mention the waste. Our friend mentioned waste, the armaments business and all that. But that's only one factor of the waste in society. What about the money system? What about the money itself? Look at the bloody banks and the building societies and all the rest of the organisation, all the machines and so on in shops dragging out money. And take one section of it, the income tax. There's thousands of employed in it, writing out bits of paper and saying you owe us this and all that bloody nonsense. I mean, it's fantastic that anybody can oppose socialism and go on supporting capitalism when this is happening before their eyes. And a socialism, if we get it before the next bloody atom bomb or whatever you call it, nuclear bomb, which will be capitalism, of course, under socialism, people will have a different outlook. They will reflect the true human nature of man. And man has got a new nature, and the nature is to be a social animal, to be on good terms with his fellow man.
And he would be today if he could, but the system of capitalism doesn't allow him to be.
Yeah, that's first. Make them shorter and shorter now, because we're running up to 9:30.
Yeah, very short. I'm not exactly sure of the position on this thing about the government program. He says that what Solzhenitsyn sort of put forward a general theory about how socialist economics will work and the non-means of one, put down the blueprint. But it seems to me that earlier on, that the Germany, in fact, did go on in a certain way, did put forward the general theory that our social society will function. He talked about the need to establish various bodies which would go out and say some kind of market research bodies to find out what people want. Yeah, and he talked about as a need to find perhaps the availability of resources and such, you know. And these are all the essential features of a general theory. So you can't accept that the soldiers are not applying themselves to this problem. They are. Now you may well say that these are not adequate or these are not satisfactory things. That's a different thing altogether. There you seem to kind of heading for to require a more detailed blueprint, you know. So it seems to me you're fluctuating between the two. First you're saying what Sartre should do is put forward a general theory. And when Sartre go ahead and do this, then you turn around and say, what I want more, I want something more detailed, I want something much more kind of precise. I'm not too sure you've got to understand that.
I'm sorry, I can't allow you to answer because the next bit is over there.
I get two impressions. One, socialism can't work because it hasn't got something to replace the price system, but it can work if it's anarchic. But I also got the impression that it's because there are no proper indicators of demand prior to supply. I work in an industry where demand and supply are practically instantaneous, and that's electricity. And electricity is a basic component of computers and all sorts of machines. And we're nowhere near socialism as far as understanding goes, but week after week, there's new systems being proposed all the time. We're talking about the cashless society. Electronic fund transfers. You won't need money if these systems are developed in the full. Get rid of a lot of people. You won't need money in your hand. And all these things are, if you like, a step. And systems which could be used under socialism without having to have a grand central plan. You have something between the two.
Well, thank you very much. We've got to get out now. Bill, could you tell us what the collection was?
£6.47.
£6.47. Thank you for the collection. And thank you for your attendance, and we hope you found it worthwhile. We meet every Thursday in the small room, number 5 on the top there, so if you want to come along and carry on some of these conversations any Thursday, by all means do. I thank you again and say good night.